Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. This week, books. Joining me on the programme for some tips to update your bookshelf this month, our publisher at Unbound, John Mitchison, and literary journalist Sarah Shaffy, staying on the bookish theme. We'll also be nipping over to Brazil to visit the newsstand come independent bookstore in Sao Paulo that's revitalised its neighbourhood. And Bill Lutie will swing by the studio for this week's Global Countdown. All that ahead on the Monocle Arts Review. John and Sarah, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Great to be back.
Two literary luminaries. This is how I'm starting 2018 with a new and enthusiastic approach. Welcome to the programme. We've got lots of great things to talk about, so let's begin. Lullaby is a psychological thriller by Leila Slimani about a nanny who's entrusted with two children of wealthy Parisian parents. Sarah, you sort of chose this one. Tell us a bit about this nanny called Louise. I'm assuming all is not as it first seems.
Well, actually, all is exactly as it first seems, because in the very first line of the book, you open with the sentences, "The baby is dead. It took only a few seconds." And from there, you're very quickly told that Louise has been responsible for the deaths of both the children in her care. And the story unravels backwards. So it's a story in which you find out what happened at the very beginning, but how it happened is the actual thrust of the novel.
John, what do you, when you first hear that sort of thing, you know, the classic reverse narrative or fractured narrative, whatever you want to call it, do you sort of approach with trepidation, or it's a reasonably solid device?
I think it's a pretty good way to open a novel. This book has had already a massive amount of coverage and excitement before its UK publication, but I think, yeah, it's like the Hemingway, the so-called Hemingway short story, isn't it? You know, baby shoes never used. The advert, as soon as you know that there's a dead baby in the book and the book is about a nanny, you're prepared. It's a great narrative device, I think.
And so what about this? I mean, I guess it's playing on that classic parental fear of the simple amount of unknown entities that you have to, by necessity, invite into your life, and they play this very key role. It's an easy fear to sort of needle away at, isn't it?
It is an easy fear to needle away at, but I think what's great about this book is that even if you hadn't had that opening chapter where you'd been told what happened, I think as a reader, you'd be astute enough to know that there is something not quite right about Louise as soon as she appears in Miriam and Paul's lives. But they're looking for a very certain type of person. Miriam wants to go back to work as a lawyer, so Louise is there ready to step in and look after the children once she starts cleaning and cooking for them and making their lives easier. They're willing to overlook anything that might seem a little bit dodgy. What's great about this novel, I think it was called it a psychological thriller at the beginning, I think that does it a bit of an injustice. I think we've seen so many psychological thrillers over the last few years that we've come to feel a bit, or I've come to feel a bit tired of them, but this is brilliant. It's very short. It's translated by Sam Taylor. I think it's important to note that because it was written in French. I don't know, I don't read French, but I think the translation is brilliant. What's great is there's no one trigger to what makes Louise commit murder. There's no sort of one incident. It's this slow seeding and this slow kind of discovery of the many different circumstances, the kind of the economic hardship, the domestic violence she suffered, the intense loneliness and alienation that she feels in a Paris that's not very kind to people that aren't rich and well off and happy.
And there is that sort of compelling slow burn narrative, John. Just on that point about translation, it is interesting, of course. It was a huge bestseller in France. And you've suggested already that it's been taken to rapidly by the English-speaking market, which I guess is testament, again, to the excellence of the translation, as Sarah said. Does these things necessarily sell? I mean, if you've got a great story, as long as it's not butchered in translation, presumably crosses borders and it crosses the linguistic divide fairly readily, or is that a mistake to think in such terms?
I think it does. Well, I think the answer is inevitably sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work as well. There are lots of books that have been massive bestsellers in Germany and France that get translated and don't quite, for one reason or another. Sometimes that might be the translation. I think sometimes it's just indefinable. It's certainly easier. I think there's such a strong narrative drive to this book, that even if it passes the sort of elevator pitch test, doesn't it?
Mm.
This is a best-selling French novel about a nanny who ends up... It's based on a true story. Slimani, Leila Slimani, kind of is incredibly articulate. She's been... I read a long profile of her in The New Yorker last week. She's kind of pushing all the buttons. If you're thinking about something that is a couple of notches on from Paula Hawkins or Gone Girl, that idea that here's a really intelligent novel that's looking at the dark side of domestic life, it's powerful. I'm definitely going to read the book.
That kind of thing about the quick pitch really works, because it's a literary novel. It won the Prix Goncourt in France, which is kind of the highest literary honour there. It's a novel so easy to pitch, and you could sell it to somebody if you're working in a literary bookshop, and you could definitely at the same time pitch it to someone who's visiting an airport bookshop on their way on holiday somewhere. It really works. The pitch works.
And she's from a Moroccan background as well, so there's kind of there's that added element of, you know, this is, you don't get that many Goncourt winners who are sort of not white French, so there's a lot of interesting boxes being ticked.
I was interested, you know, is it more intelligent because of its treatment of issues around whether it's race or class or motherhood? So, you know, there's just more thoughtful provocations, if you like, than just the narrative, which is, yeah, sure. Rip-roarer and very appealing.
Yeah, you can read it on...
You see what I mean? You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. You can read it on a number of levels. You can read it as kind of a straight-out thriller, a how-done-it, if you will, or you can read it as a commentary on society and class and race and faith and all of those kind of other things.
There you go. A Lullaby by Leila Slimani is out now. It's published by Faber and Faber. Our next book is the latest novel by Louise Erdrich called Future, Home of the Living God. John, this is set... We're in a dystopian future, I guess.
We are.
Humanity's going backwards. Is that a dystopian future or is it right now? That's another chat. Tell us the kind of world that we're taking into.
Okay, so the book is essentially, it's a letter, a notebook, but to the child, that the main character, who is called Cedar Hawk Songmaker, who is a 32-year-old woman who has been adopted by an impeccably liberal couple in Minnesota, and who decides when she becomes pregnant that she wants to find her birth mother. And her birth mother turns out to be a Ojibwe Indian Native American living on a reservation called Mary Potts. And the book starts with her going back to find her birth mother and her birth mother's other daughter, Little Mary, and also Eddie, who is a sort of extraordinary... He's written a 3,000-page narrative basically about his life. He suffers from fairly extreme bipolar disorder. All of that, the reservation, you know, that Erdrich is the thing that she's known for. She writes brilliantly about contemporary Native American life in La Rose and some of the previous novels. But the framing of this is, yes, that people, not only human beings are beginning to give birth to hominids, versions of humanity, Neanderthals or even earlier than that. That's plunging the whole of the United States into a massive crisis. Obvious references to Handmaid's Tale, obvious references, I guess, to even P.D. James's book, Children of Men, Never Let Me Go, the Ishiguro novel. Not only is it, evolution appears to be running backwards, so there's an amazing moment when what looks like an archaeopteryx appears in the back garden. So it's not just, it's plants and animals are genetically sort of reverting to previous kind of versions of themselves. So interesting premise, pregnant woman on the run, because obviously they're rounding up pregnant women because they're, you know, they're a danger, apparently a danger to themselves. A lot of women are dying in childbirth because they're giving birth to larger, more complicated shaped babies. So there's a massive amount of jeopardy. So the book, I kind of, in a way, is at one level, it's an on the run. Will she or won't she get caught and thrown into prison? She gets caught. She gets thrown into prison without too many spoilers. I won't go tell you the whole plot. But it's also a meditation on motherhood, about what motherhood means if you don't know what you're carrying. I mean, if you're assuming that it's a baby. So there's an ongoing, beautifully done. I mean, it's a exquisitely written book. It's not maybe the book you would give to somebody who's pregnant, I was thinking as I was reading it. I think the dystopia is pretty well realised. The bits that I really responded to were, again, it was the Native American the bits that you feel are the less familiar parts of North American life that Erdrich seems to be absolutely, as somebody such a sort of poet laureate of. And I think the bigger picture, it's an interesting, I mean, I'm not sure it entirely works, but it's fascinating, great story, and you read it in large gulps because you want to get to the end.
It's interesting. There's some themes there about the challenges or mysteries or fears of motherhood, but also this sense of a book, you know, of prescience, of it's apposite for our time. Mm. I always marvel at how brilliant, you know, novelists are. Do they actually know? Are they future seers even when they publish these works that seem to be just right? But this sounds like something that is, if we're talking about society regressing and people evolving backwards, you said, John, I mean, that's somehow, you look certainly across the pond as well, and it feels like the right moment.
I mean, I've read a few books recently, and I can think of a few that will be coming out over the next few months that do discuss things like reproductive rights, which is obviously something that is going on in American discourse at the moment, and kind of various other things. And I don't know what it is about novelists, but I think they can get to the core of things that we worry about. And those things that we worry about, we don't just solve, I mean, we'll come onto it later, but we don't just solve racism. We don't just solve sexism. You know, they're ongoing issues. And John mentioned The Handmaid's Tale, which is, what, 30 years old now, mid-80s? And I mean, last year everyone was like, oh, The Handmaid's Tale is so relevant. But it, I mean, it's because these issues don't go away. We don't just suddenly put a tick beside them and sort of say, we're done, we've solved it.
And I think what Erdrich is doing is, it's a brave book in some ways. She's exploring what the mystical, more complicated... Cedar, because she's got impeccably liberal parents, becomes a Catholic. That's her sort of her way of rebelling. And one of the, there's a really great moment early in the book where she finds there's a shrine to the Virgin Mary in the on the reservation at the back of her mum, Sweetie's, her birth mum's house. And there's a fantastic moment. And then there is the whole thing. There's a saint that's been seen on the reservation of a Native American woman from the 17th century. So there's a whole cult of saints thing. So she's dealing with when we are absolutely kind of, you know, when our lives are in danger, when all our certainties, the most basic certainty of all that we're going to give birth to a child, when that's thrown into... And, you know, people do reach out for you know, metaphysical comfort, that they reach out for faith, they reach out for ritual. And there's a lot of that in the book, which she manages, I think, really, really well. It's not a comfortable read, any of it. But she's a very good novelist. All the main characters, the impeccable liberals, as well as her apparently staunch boyfriend who is introduced as an angel, doesn't turn out to be quite that, like you would expect from this. I think her 16th novel. I mean, she knows what she's doing with the narrative, and it's hard not to read these books through the prism of what's going on in the States at the moment.
Future Home of the Living God by Louise Erdrich is out now, published by Little Brown. Our next read is a novel by Mary Lynn Bratt, an American writer of Korean descent. This is her debut book, White Chrysanthemum. It's set in the southern tip of Korea. Here we meet two sisters, Hannah and Emmy, who find themselves suddenly separated by war. Sarah, this has been, again, hotly tipped. The Guardian, I think, said a debut to look out for. Why should this be one that's on our nightstand to read?
Ugh, I hate to sound so basic, but it's just so good. I mean,
This is a good recommendation.
I mean, I cried my way through most of it. But I mean, it's brilliant. So yeah, two sisters. So there's kind of two stories being told in it. In the 1940s, Hannah, who, you'll have to excuse my pronunciation here, she is a hinyo, which is a woman who makes her living diving deep into the sea off the coast of Korea. So a society made up of female breadwinners. She is kidnapped and becomes a comfort woman, which is a really innocuous phrase, but she's basically sold into sexual slavery for the Japanese army. So every other chapter is Hannah's story. And then in the present day, we are with her younger sister, Emmy, who Hannah basically saved from the same fate. And Emmy is on a pilgrimage, basically, that she undertakes every year. And it's kind of the unravelling of what happened to her. It's an incredibly moving story, a really, really tough read in parts, because the things Hannah goes through, which are all things that women went through at that period who were sold basically to serve the Japanese army, are horrific. but it's a really rewarding read as well.
Well, it's interesting, and there's, as you say, sort of brutal and challenging stuff to read. But John, it is interesting, again, here we're talking about a period in history, but even today, if you are on the Korean Peninsula, you know, it's a difficult subject to broach, and obviously the diplomatic relationships between Korea and Japan, hugely complex. Is this a sort of thing that requires a great writer to tackle, maybe in a novel, because that way you can scratch away and you can actually break through some of those very hard to crack veneers, maybe?
Well, I think that is what fiction does, in a way that you can't really... The thing about a great novel, and this does sound, I haven't read it, but it just does sound really compelling. It's that ability to, the fact that it's set in Korea might be coincidental, but you do feel that novelists are drawn to places where there are these fractures, because it's in these sort of kind of conflict is where great storytelling, I think, comes into its own. You know, it's hard to sometimes to get that degree of what sounds like amazing page-turning, emotional wrenching from, you know, the life in a quiet English village. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, the Archers is...
they do their best.
I mean, the other thing that Marilyn Brach does is she's found a story that's largely untold definitely in Western literature, and really shines a light on it. So I learnt so much from this book, and it's one of those books that you read and then you're going away and you're kind of looking for further reading on, for like further non-fiction reading on the topic. And I love novels that are not only great stories and kind of touch you emotionally, but that can also teach you something sometimes as well.
I think that's a hugely important thing about fiction, is that it's a way of grappling with a culture, of learning about a culture that I think you were saying it before, that it's the nuance, isn't it? It's that there isn't any easy... You're not going to learn about a culture in 10 minutes or from reading a guidebook, but getting some kind of sense of what... I mean, that's certainly what I felt in The Erdrich as well. You get a sense of what unfamiliar lives are really like in fiction, in a way that it's almost impossible to do, I think. I don't think you get it in drama or film in quite the same way, because of the internalised nature of reading. You feel that you are inside characters in a way.
Well, that sort of humanity into the history, which, again, you can think of certain occupants of various offices that would be well served with understanding a bit more of the human experience. Yeah. Maybe, not the most empathetic. What about the sort of writerly techniques on display here, Sarah? Again, it's interesting. The structure, again, we switch sort of between and amongst narratives. Mm. Again, I assume from your enthusiastic endorsement that all of those structural forms, again, it works very well and it's very coherent.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is two stories about two different people in two different times, but they do, the way they ebb and flow together and kind of reading about Hannah in one time, I'm thinking, what would Emmy have thought if she'd known this was happening? And reading about Emmy in the present, who feels a lot of guilt and a lot of sadness and thinking about, well, what would Hannah have said to her, because Hannah made the ultimate sacrifice for her sister and was kidnapped in her place. What would she have said? She'd have carried on protecting her. I think the two narratives work really well together.
Challenging stuff, as we mentioned, but it's good for the soul, nevertheless. White Chrysanthemums by Mary Lynn Brach is out now. It's published by Chatto and Windus. Finally, let's switch to non-fiction for our last pick. Brit-ish on Race, Identity and Belonging is an investigation into Britain's troubled relationship with race, now and throughout history, indeed. John Mitchison, in the past couple of years, we've had various tomes, The Good Immigrant, we've had Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race, and so on, which sort of get into this area. Does this pick up somewhat where they left off? Is there a different take on, you know, racism and race relations, as they used to say?
I think it's not that it takes up on him. I think it adds to the conversation in a really admirable way. I think it's a very, very calm, sane book, although speaking as a white person reading it, you wince really all the way through it, because I think Sarah was saying before, you know, we like to feel that we're a multicultural society and we're moving towards the post-racial. That isn't the experience of a lot of people of colour. And Ephra Hirsch, who is of mixed race, mixed heritage, her dad is white, Jewish, and her mum is Ghanaian. But, you know, she had that difficult thing of being not quite black enough for some of the, You know, when she goes back to Ghana, for example, she becomes West Africa correspondent. But obviously, as far as her white schoolmates, and she comes privileged background, private school, went to Oxford. But what she does is she unpicks all of that. There's just, if I can read, it's just a brilliant little passage which sort of explains exactly what I think the power of this book is. Is she talks about her struggle, one I've come to discover is shared by so many others. Found me because I was marked from birth in British society as other. Years of my life were devoted establishing that this is what happened. Then I needed to understand how it happened. Then I needed to understand why. There is no manual that provides an explanation for your lived experience as a brown child growing up in this society. A lot of the time, there is not even an acknowledgement that there is anything to explain. You have to work it out for yourself. I think I have, and I've written about what I've learned in this book so that I can hold on to it and so that others don't have to start from scratch. Which is a really, it captures exactly. I'm reasonably good on history, but, you know, it is still shocking when you discover passages of the history of the British Empire that you know, this is stuff that we aren't taught in schools, and we should be. I mean, the absolute obverse of all of our feeling that we're generous and welcoming and open is that, yes, we're very proud. There's a brilliant bit about the cult of Wilberforce. You know, we're very proud of the fact that we got rid of slavery. But in fact, you know, the empire is built on slavery. The empire is built on the money of slavery. And that continued well in, you know, the proceeds of that continued well into the 20th century. So there's a lot that's difficult. But she balances that, you know, really interesting, well-researched historical stuff with her own personal story. And I think in its way, it's an exemplary book. And I think what she's, I think, setting out to do is to try and get us to think a little bit more deeply about identity, the sense that Britishness, that we assume everybody fits into neatly because it's so inclusive, isn't working. A lot of particularly younger people of colour are not feeling that Britishness is working as an identity for them. And that is an issue. And I think this book is a really honourable and useful way of furthering the conversation.
And so with that sort of depth, both of personal experience, of mastery of the history, and again, of writerly expertise, does this book stand a chance? Is it too much to heap onto its narrow shoulders to say, you know, this could help to spark a change in exactly that conversation, which John is saying remains still so overdue?
I would be reluctant to place that kind of change on any one book, because it's also not the job of one author of colour to kind of push this sort of change. The racism of this sort, the sort that F. W. Hirsch is talking about, or the definition of British identity, doesn't come from people of colour. It comes from white people. And that's where a lot of the discussion needs to be happening. And it's unfair to say, well, here's a book by a person of colour, follow this guide, because it's not on us as people of colour to solve the issue. Having said that, I think it's an incredible book. For me, it was the personal stuff that really, really stood out. This idea that, yeah, she grew up in a family, a mixed heritage family in Wimbledon, which was incredibly white and incredibly middle class, and never felt British enough, and thought all her problems would be solved going to Ghana, and then none of them were solved. And even within London, her partner is from, I think, is he from Tottenham?
And he comes from a much blacker environment. So, and there's that brilliant stuff where he said he just wouldn't do middle class dinner parties, and and a lot of her friends don't believe that she's actually got a boyfriend.
Yeah, I mean, the thing for me, and I think it says it in the blurb of the book, is this book really starts from that point that people of colour, and certainly I've been asked this multiple times, is where are you from? No, where are you really from? And that's kind of the question that she's trying to answer, because if she doesn't fit into the narrow definition of British identity, yet this is where she's grown up, then where is she really from?
And I think that point that you make, Sarah, about that she's very good on whiteness as being an identity. But it's that's an identity that people don't see. It reminded me in bits of that another book that you can add to this sort of pile of really interesting books that are making the conversation deeper. With We Were 8 Years in Power, Ta-Nehisi Coates, where there's, you know, the first his essay on Trump, the first white president, is one of the most powerful. It's the recognition that the problem, insofar as there is a problem, is not people of colour. It's with white people recognizing what whiteness is and that the effect that is an identity that they don't, you know, you have to become aware of that identity in a way that if you're a person of color in this society, you're continually reminded you are other.
What's that thing where white people are uncomfortable sometimes being referred to as white people because they've always been used to being referred to as people. Which is, I think, a whole big discussion for another time. But I think it's one of the things that comes up that we're all very much, there's an argument about we think about identity politics too much these days, but we need to think about identity politics. That's at the core of how we kind of go about looking at these issues that are affecting society.
It's a brave book too. There's a really pretty ghastly early thing in when she goes to a swingers club, which is all sort of black men and white women. What I like about it is she doesn't flinch. She goes and she looks at the things that are most difficult. And as I say, that it's hard not to wince at various points as a white person reading the book and realising exactly just that this is so complex, but it'll only improve if both sides of the argument, of the discussion, bring the truth. And that's what she does. Mm. I think brilliant. It's an incredibly honest book.
British, On Race, Identity and Belonging by Afua Hirsch is out now. It's published by Penguin. Sarah and John, thank you both for your book reviews today. Before we round off the show with our global countdown, we're going to continue the literary theme with a quick trip to Brazil, where a vibrant independent literary scene has been growing steadily in recent years. Dozens of small publishing houses have sprung up with emphasis on creativity and originality rather than just selling books. Meanwhile, a boom in book fairs and festivals has given them a platform to reach new audiences, and they've made a spiritual home at the Banca Tatuí in Sao Paulo. It's an old-fashioned newsstand which has been converted into a bookshop and mini cultural space, and it's had a transformational effect on the surrounding area. We sent our own Frederick Bernas to find out more.
At first glance, the corner of Rua Barão de Tatuí and Rua Imaculada Conceição looks like any other street in Sao Paulo. A small kiosk sits at the intersection, the kind which normally sells newspapers, snacks and cigarettes. But the Banca Tatuí is painted bright yellow, and there are no sugary temptations in sight. Every crevice of the fetching wood-panelled interior is filled with colourful creations. Novels, magazines, leaflets, postcards, picture books and more. They're produced by more than 160 independent publishers, many of which use artisanal techniques, like analog typography or silk screen printing, as well as special types of paper. But that emphasis on bringing back the human touch in today's digital age doesn't mean that newer technology has been forgotten. Here's Josélia Aguiar, the current curator of FLIP, Brazil's premier literary festival.
Ao mesmo tempo em que eles resgatam técnicas antigas de produção e impressão,
at the same time as old production techniques are being rescued, these publishers are also very connected. They do all their promotion on the internet, with virtual shops and social networks, so you can't say they're just reviving the past. It's a contemporary scene being created by young people who know how to reach exactly the audience they need. They've formed a circuit which sells between its own members. I very rarely see anything of low quality. People circulate in the scene and know each other's work. Everybody helps one another. And it's getting bigger all the time.
The Banca Tatuí often writes or speaks as itself, in the first person, inviting people to events and announcing book releases via social media.
Está confirmado. Eu tenho os melhores amigos leitores do planeta, do universo, da galáxia.
Behind those words are two journalists, João Varela and Cecília Arbolave, who started the project in 2014. The couple, who also run a small publishing company called Lot 42, have lived in the Santa Cecília neighbourhood for more than a decade. One day, they saw the dilapidated kiosk opposite their building was up for sale, so they jumped at the chance. João Varela says that creating a home for indie publishing was vital in a tough commercial sector dominated by large corporations.
É que uma livraria ela tá mais focada naqueles best sellers, né, nos mega sellers.
Traditional bookstores don't pay as much attention. They're more focused on bestsellers, which are usually fictional works translated from foreign languages, because those are the most guaranteed sellers. There's not much interest in developing local authors, so we want to take that risk and experiment, but Brazilian stores don't see our work as very palatable. That's why we needed a space where the shop window is our own, and for other small publishers.
Nossa e de outras editoras pequenas, né?
The translation trend is reflected by national market data. In 2012, just two of the top 20 books sold in Brazil were written by Brazilians. But things have improved in the last few years, with the bestseller list divided evenly between national and international authors since 2015. It would be rather far-fetched to say the Banca Tatuí is responsible for that shift, but it's emblematic of a positive change. And one thing which cannot be disputed is the impact the kiosk has had on its local area, as João explains.
Essa esquina aqui era chamada Ladrão de Tatuí com Emaconhada Conceição.
At night, it used to be dangerous here. This corner was a drug sales point, but that stopped when we opened up. More businesses are moving in now. I don't want to say the banca was a panacea which changed everything, but it definitely contributed. We started believing that public safety issues can be resolved without the police. Sometimes you bring more people to frequent a space, and people care for people. So gradually, the drugs faded away. Today, it's peaceful and safe.
Ativamente essa boca de fumo foi desaparecendo até que não existe mais.
He told me that locals even nicknamed the road Robber of Tatuí, swapping the Portuguese word ladrão for the original barão, which means baron. The corner lived up to its sinister reputation when thieves broke into the stand just days after João and Cecília had purchased it. So they doubled down on security, reinforcing the roof, which is now strong enough to use as a pop-up stage for street parties.
Ele não quer mais a sua companhia, baby.
On the morning of my visit to the banca, I met Mario Melilli, the son of Italian migrants who moved to Brazil when he was a child. At the age of 70, Mario has observed 6 decades of life in Santa Cecília. He regularly stops by the kiosk to flick through books and chat.
Aqui, livraria só mais perto do centro, a grande livraria.
There aren't many bookstores around here, and the old newspaper stand used to be completely different. It was a place for homeless people and drugs, with lots of closed shops. Now, it's more calm. When my father opened his first business nearby, everybody thought he was crazy. But you have to believe in things, and it evolves. Today, there's even a shopping center in the area, so it's all part of a bigger process. Every neighborhood has its own life.
Porque cada bairro hoje tem a sua vida própria.
Ele já não quer mais a sua companhia, baby.
By contributing to urban change and bringing new literature to diverse groups of people, the Banca Tatuí transcends the act of merely selling books. It's become a real nexus for the indie publishing community, strengthening a dynamic movement that will surely keep gaining momentum as the word spreads. Figuratively and literally. For Monocle, in São Paulo, I'm Frederick Bernard.
Thanks to Frederick Bernas for that report. Now to end the programme, of course, we have our global countdown. Fernando couldn't be here this week, so we've enlisted the help of Monocle's Bill Luty. Bill, hello to you.
Hi, Tom.
Where in the world are you transporting us to through the power of song, quite literally?
So we're going to China. This is the Chinese V chart. The V stands for video. They've got basically it's like their version of YouTube called Yin Yu Tai. But the songs are put up there by the record labels, so it's pretty accurate as far as who's listening. And this is how the majority of people listen. So it's as accurate as our singles chart might be.
Okay, well, let's start, shall we, with number 5.
That's a good place to start. This is Jackson Wang. He's a Hong Kong rapper based in South Korea. Tom, you might know him. He's a member of GOT7.
Oh, of course. Stalwarts on the Monocle 24 playlist.
While I was looking up stuff about this, he trained for 2 entire years before he was even allowed to be in that band. So they've got quite high expectations of their members.
Should have put you through that kind of rigorous training program
before
you joined the staff. No. Okay, should we have a little listen?
Yeah, so well, before we do that, GOT7 are quite poppy. This is quite hip-hoppy. I told myself that I'll be okay.
Oh, that was prompting discussions almost immediately, Bill. That was okay.
That's okay. Yeah. Quite a lot of it's in English, which I think is quite interesting. Maybe he's trying to break into the US markets. Who knows?
What are his prospects, Bill, in a word?
I think he's got good prospects. The video has got it all. It's got like bling, there's fire, there's like a goat. He's got his top off in the shower.
It's a goat.
A deer. There's a deer that appears.
That makes it okay then.
Yeah, in the shower. He's got like a sexy silk bathrobe on at one point. Okay. So yeah, I think he's gonna go places.
He's going places. Okay, what's at four?
Number four, a guy called Joker Zhu. He's from Shanghai. And his first album was back in 2006. Then he had a brief hiatus. Then he came back in 2016. And this is his new album, released in November last year. People absolutely love him, but I'm not quite sure why.
Okay. Shall we take a listen and see if we can see if the independent-minded people can make their own minds up? Okay, what's the name of the track at number four?
Don't. This is Don't.
别不安,只是还有习惯,别喜欢我长期的勇敢。Wow.
Yeah, it's a ballad, isn't it?
It's a plangent ballad.
The subject of the video, I'm not sure if the song matches, is he's mourning over the death of his girlfriend after they flipped their car in icy conditions. So
it's just a road safety thing.
It's quite bleak. And he's like moping around the house and more snow is falling as he's having flashbacks to this horrific accident.
So can I just say, I couldn't understand the lyrics, but I felt he did capture... He captured that sort of slightly fatal note.
Yeah.
Maybe we should move to number three, Bill.
Number three, well, you think we're moving on. We're not. It's by Joker Zhu again.
Oh, no.
He's back. This one's called Camel.
Okay.
So he released his album, which is called The Crossing, back in November, and he just put all of the tracks up. So the reason that there's so many of these are him is because people are just listening to the album, and therefore it's getting so many. It's a bit like last year when Ed Sheeran was like number one, two, three, four, five, all the way through.
So following that logic, do we need to listen to Camel, or
can we
can
give it a listen?
Okay, a quick bit of Camel for you.
努力进化小动物世界都代价祖先已抹去朝阳将爱向沙一定有更好的办法攀比下谁先归下
That did sound... It reminded me of Don't a little bit, Bill.
It's quite similar, isn't it? I think I prefer Camel.
Is it odd?
I think you're so hard. I think if I was 12, I'd be into this. Yeah.
Really?
If I was in China and I was... Yeah.
He's quite handsome, but he's like 36, so he hasn't got the youth...
Whoa. But careful where you're going with this. And what would be wrong with anything in that vicinity? Yeah. Nothing. Let's move on to number two before you upset anyone else.
Number two, Roy Wang... I've talked about Roy Wang before. He's in a band called the TF Boys, who are like the superstars of the Chinese pop scene.
A chuckle. I can only describe it as a chuckle of recognition from John Mitchell. Obviously, he's got all their other albums.
They're selling $17 million of branded merchandise a month.
Amazing.
What?
Okay, so that's
a lot.
Massive
a lot
Twitter
of stuff.
Following.
Yeah, a lot of T-shirts. Time named Roy Wang one of the 30 most influential teens of 2017 last year. That's not Chinese Time, that's actual Time
Around
magazine.
So Roy Wang, okay, and what's the name of the track? This is a solo effort.
It's
number two in the charts. What's it called, Bill?
It's called Sleep. It's a ballad.
That was Sleep by Roy Wang. Yes, John, of the TFBoys. Stop going on about them. We know you're a fan.
So, can I just say, that song is entirely in English, so he is definitely looking to branch out.
He's going
to
be a crossover artist. Bill, we've helter-skelter, pell-mell to the top of the tree.
What's
a number one? As long as it's not Joe Kazoo.
Who on earth could be at number one?
Is it?
It's Joe Kazoo.
Is it another ballad, though?
Well, this one is a little bit more interesting. I think we just need to go straight in with a clip.
Kind of 80s synth.
It's darker, isn't it?
Definitely. Change of pace from Joker Zoo there.
It's basically just that throughout. I think it needs like one more little bit. It needs a middle eight. It needs a break of some sort.
Well, it's top of the tree though, Bill.
But it's number one and you can't argue with that, can you?
So that's three of the top five.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's big.
Joker Zoo.
At the beginning of that video, since it's the V chart, there's a kind of like hooded northern Englishman who... says some
hoodie,
kind of
Bill, is he describing
the hooded? He's like a sorcerer, but he's got a slight like northern accent.
Oh, now that you've said that, it's got a like a witchy vibe.
And this song, The Crossing,
is it Joker as in Joker, or is it Joker Zoo?
No, it's Joker. Used to be called Jackie, and then he changed his name to Joker.
It's good.
But this song is about the ferryman. It's got the ferryman taking people across to the other side.
Right. I feel like I've been on that journey. Isn't there in his videos?
A lot of
camel
death.
And ferryman.
It's a great album, clearly, with some inspired song titles.
Very good. Bill, that was great fun. Thank you for that. The world of Joker Zoo. Revealed to us all, which is a relief, I think. Thank you very much for guiding us through it. That brings us to the end of today's programme. Thanks to Bill, and thanks to my guests, John Mitchison and Sarah Shafi. This show was produced by Holly Fisher, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. I'm Tom Edwards. We'll be back with more at the same time next week. But let's play you out with... Bill, what else could it be? A little bit more of The Crossing, his Joker Zoo again. Thank you.